Welcome to SILRAP Podcasts. You are about to listen to a service of the Center for International Law Research and Policy.
I will make a few remarks on legal goods protected by international crimes of genocide. We start with the wording of the list of the crimes. It is not the treaty, the convention, in which the list of the acts of genocide we want to study. It is not the object and purpose of the treaty or the statute of a tribunal that we need to consider when we look for legal goods of a specific offense, but it is the wording on the offense. And from the list, we can constitute, I think, a basic foundational level of at least three legal goods protected by crimes of genocide. One is individual life of group members, which is a legal good shared by murder as an ordinary national or domestic crime. A second is integrity of group members, individual integrity, either physical integrity or mental integrity. And a third would seem to be a legal good of family, seen from the perspective of parents vis-a-vis children, the child vis-a-vis the parents, or, you know, more fundamentally, the DNA pool of the family in question. And the last refers to the crime listed in E, forcibly transferring children of the group to another group, a conduct which may not entail any taking of life or any physical or mental harm being caused. The first of the acts, killing members of the group, I think quite clearly refers to individual life. The second, causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group, I have indicated, speak to physical or mental integrity. The third crime against crime of genocide, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part, would seem to address both life and integrity. And the fourth and last would be imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group, which can be both life and integrity. You can kill pregnant women belonging to the targeted group, or you can conduct forcible abortions to terminate their pregnancies, not killing them, but subjecting them to a treatment that would be often tantamount to torture, grave violation of physical integrity. On top of this, we have what the International Court of Justice, in its advisory opinion already from 1951, articulated as the main legal good of crimes of genocide, namely the continued existence of the protected group as such, or continued group existence. And this is distilled from the common element of the crimes of genocide, which is actually a mere intent description, which I have indicated here as a quotation, with intent to destroy in whole or in part a national, ethnical, racial, or religious group as such. We can call the latter a broad legal good. Yeah, it's not the term collective, which we have in the German expression kollektiven Rechtsgüter. And we can call the former the crime-specific legal goods and narrow legal goods. There is a duality for a number of the core international crimes between the broad level of values or goods protected and the narrow or specific level. And they, in reality, blend and merge together in a composite normative construction. There is real fog in the discourse space when you listen to lawyers talk about what the crimes they are trying to uphold responsibility for protect. There is a very high level of confusion, even among colleagues of mine who have worked maybe for 15 or 20 years in international criminal jurisdictions. If you really sit them down and push them question after question after question, they are actually unable to articulate a clear understanding of the values they are dedicating day after day after day to protect. I think that is the sad reality. And I therefore think we cannot criticize academia for not having given proper attention to the whole idea of legal goods in international criminal law. It is one of the massive lacuna, major gaps in the literature of international criminal law today, in my humble opinion. So, if that is the case, how do we start to make sense of the terrain of legal goods in international criminal law? Well, it may be helpful to develop some tentative distinctions or discourse markers. And here are six, and there are surely others. And the moment the lawyers and philosophers do start to apply their minds to this, this is where there will be an explosion in the tools that we have available, because we will quickly see the complexities and that A is not B, etc. I have already introduced the distinction between narrow and broad legal goods. I started with this because it's really quite passive. It is not an aggressive, impulsive distinction. And it seems, to me, commonsensical. Secondly, there is, in my view, a distinction between legal goods and object and purpose. And this is really important because many of the core international crimes, they originate from a treaty. Or if they are active and they are being employed in a jurisdiction, they originate from the statute of that jurisdiction. But attached to treaties and statutes are a whole series of broad fundamental objects and purposes, and they may not be the same as what underpins specific norms that are prescriptive norms, that are offenses, that are crimes. So this is the first thing to keep in mind. If we talk about the legal goods of crimes of genocide, one should be very careful with how one reads and cites the Genocide Convention, where we have the first list of genocidal acts from 1948, because the Genocide Convention is trying to do a whole number of things, both with regard to punishment, but also with regard to prevention. Thirdly, we can make a distinction between individual and collective legal goods. And this is a distinction which the German concept and theory immediately invites us to make, because it uses the term collective legal goods. The legal goods, I write in the slide, the legal good refers to primary benefits or is primarily carried by individuals or wider collectivities. So those are three different functions of legal goods. They attach to individuals or collectivities in three different ways. Fourthly, we can distinguish between principal and subsidiary legal goods. Subsidiary for the same carrier, an individual or a state, or as we will see, the international community, or another actor. For example, international peace and security, which arguably is a United Nations charter-based legal good of general public international law may best be associated with the collectivity of the international community, more so than with individual states, which are also collectivities, but collectivities that are less encompassing. Even when you are in a populous country like India, that remains true. Five, there may be meta legal goods and ordinary legal goods. Meta legal goods may be values such as reconciliation, which we will hear about, unity, solidarity, which we heard about earlier, or well-being, whereas regular legal goods may both be broad, like continued group existence, or narrow, such as individual life. We can also make a distinction between qualitative and quantitative legal goods. Standards such as humanity would seem to be qualitative in my reading, and if we look at the historical origins, whereas collectivity legal goods such as civilian population or ethnic group can be seen as quantitative. Humanity is puzzling us and we are struggling with it, and I'm not sure Lauterpacht and others were thinking of those consequences when they actually were looking for a suitable label to be able to prosecute Nazis for what they did to German Jews. But we are stuck with the term, and we do need to try to make sense of it, also for the purpose of seeing which additional terms, concepts, we need to develop the discipline further. We can make a tentative list like this of possible principal broad legal goods protected by the core international crimes today. It's a list of nine, starting with protected property. Two, avoiding unnecessary suffering. Three, protected persons and, in a related manner, civilians. Four, civilian population. Five, territorial integrity. Six, political independence. Seven, international peace and security. Eight, continued group existence. And nine, humanity. Structured by category of crime, it would look like this. And the earlier speaker, Song Tianying, will be able to correct my reading of war crimes, but it seems to me that protected persons and civilians would be one important category, as would protected property, and for the crimes concerning illegal weapons, avoiding unnecessary suffering. For aggression, I ask various colleagues who were involved in the negotiations on the crime of aggression in the context of the International Criminal Court, why are we doing this? What will the crime of aggression protect against? And you get a whole range of answers from persons who have been involved in negotiations for a number of years. One favorite topic seems to be sovereignty. It's the crime that protects sovereignty. But that is a very interesting proposition. Again, I think we need to go to the definition, the wording of the crime, and what comes to us immediately is territorial integrity, the territory of states. It's not the same as sovereignty or the UN Charter concept, which is sovereign equality. And the other is political independence, the ability to exercise jurisdiction, the ability to have effective jurisdiction. Is international peace and security a value protected by the crime of aggression? Well, I would really and truly hope so. It's listed here. Crimes against humanity. Yes, we have heard Professor Lam talk about humanity and the qualitative problems with this term. We also have in the common element of crimes against humanity the requirement of a link to civilian population, which is another collectivity. So I have listed it here for the sake of having a list. And of course, this list will, if the discourse move forward, be refined and expanded, and others will come up with better and more qualified lists. And finally, for genocide, continued group existence. We can make another table where we look at the question, well, whose legal goods are they in terms of the first line of enjoyment? So this concerns a relational definition. And the middle column proposes who is in the first line of enjoyment of the legal good. Yes, so for protected property in the category of war crimes, it would seem to be the owners and or users of the protected property. Avoiding unnecessary suffering, it would seem to be the victims of weapons that cause unnecessary suffering. Protected persons, it would seem to be attacked protected persons. And again, civilian population, it would seem to be the attacked population. Political independence, it would seem to be the attacked state. And for territorial integrity, likewise, and for international peace and security, and this is perhaps the point of this slide, my proposition is that it is the international community, primarily. For humanity, arguably, it is all human beings. We can make a further visual illustration to open up the discourse space. An axis showing vertically the degree to which the legal good feels or seems tangible. The lower on the axis, the higher level of tangibility, the higher on the axis, the more non-tangible it feels. And I'm not attaching any value to whether it is tangible or not tangible. And on the other axis, the scope of the primary holders of the legal good. Protected property would seem to be very tangible, yeah? And it concerns the jurisdictional parameters of war crimes, which we will see in a moment, are quite limited in terms of the scope of individuals they encompass, taking into account that there must be an armed conflict. Protected persons would seem to be around the same place. Avoiding unnecessary suffering concerns even fewer individuals. Territorial integrity concerns the state, and it is beginning to become more abstract. International peace and security, certainly if we look at the level of dispute or controversy, when one tries to invoke or apply to a fact set, the standard would seem to be even more abstract or less tangible. Continued group existence, likewise, civilian population, in the context of crimes against humanity, likewise, political independence, even higher than territorial integrity, and humanity may be the most vague or the least tangible, but potentially the value that embraces the largest number of humans. We go back to where we started yesterday morning during my introductory remarks, where I suggested that one must add a basement below the level of discussing criminalization, and in addition to considerations of harm and the methodology of considering harm, namely the basement of underlying legal goods. So, of the list of nine possible broad legal goods, we start with territorial integrity and political independence. They are both attached to the state. Yeah. We go to continued existence of a national, ethnical, racial, or religious group as such. Well, the Bosnian Muslims existed at one time in Bosnia and as a displaced population outside Bosnia. The Albanians in the Balkans exist in Kosovo, Macedonia, and Albania. A religious group or an ethnic group may exist beyond the borders of a state and not be limited to a state. So actually, this notion of a collectivity is less limited or constrained by than our territorial integrity and political independence. And then we have protected persons and related civilians. Well, they are actually entirely within the state because they refer to the citizens of an enemy state. So they are actually among the most restricted legal goods in terms of their reach. Civilian population in the context of crimes against humanity could, if you have crimes against humanity occurring on a scale involving several states, actually refer to a collectivity that goes beyond one nation state and goes beyond citizenship. So it is wider than the state. And then comes international peace and security. And as the slide suggests, it is the first of the listed principal broad legal goods that would actually be carried by the international community, a collectivity on that level. And the only other existing principal broad legal good we have that does that is humanity. Whereas international peace and security would be a value of primarily the international community, humanity speaks to all humankind and to all human beings, as would qualitative legal goods such as solidarity, unity, or well-being of mankind, to go back to Vattel from yesterday. So what does this show us? Well, first of all, it shows us that this list of values is excluded from the reach of international criminal law as it stands today. All humankind, I argue, is not directly protected by any existing international crime. One did not choose the word humankind for crimes against humanity very deliberately because one did not want to protect a collectivity. That wasn't the point, and that would have created a whole range of new problems, theoretical and other problems. One chose a word that pointed towards equality and not a quantity. Nature is not protected as such, the human habitat. All residents of one or the other collectivity are also not protected. The well-being of members of large collectivities not, and unity and reconciliation, certainly unity, would seem not to be. With reconciliation, one can argue that it has received several forms of recognition and is at an advanced stage of becoming a legal good of international criminal law, but Judge Baragwanath will address this in the next session. Point one, most international criminal law legal goods are linked to or centered on the state. We must recognize that. No existing legal good embraces all of humankind as a collectivity, neither its well-being, unity, or its habitat, nature. This deficiency is dated, and it does not correspond to the contemporary agenda of global problems and needs. It also does not recognize the structure of the identity of many of us. I guess many in this room would really say they feel more like a global or world citizen than a citizen of Norway or another state. Or maybe even, I am more a citizen of the European Union than of a particular member state of the European Union. It also does not see how many of us see and associate with other humans and humankind as a whole. The constraint gives the construction of the state, the mental construction of the state, a disproportionate role at the expense of human beings, at the center of what international criminal law seeks to protect and do, and the role it seeks to have. And this constrains the role international criminal law can play. So with that, I say thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. For more open access audio recordings, films, and publications, go to silrap.org.